This episode of Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald, was first broadcast on the 16th of April 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. This week we are bringing you a roundup of our highlights from the live broadcasts we did during the 52nd annual Salone del Mobile in Milan, which took place last week. Coming up over the next hour, we'll get crafty with the Danish creative director spearheading a global craft revival from Kyoto, Thomas Licker.
For us it was very important not only to just show craftsmanship in the more traditional, conservative way, but really to show the new movement and energy from Kyoto, and in that sense also build a sustainable business platform on a global market.
We'll find out why robots might be taking over the design world from MIT professor Carlo Ratti.
You know, in the end, all of this is not about technology, it's about humans. It's about, you know, how we can do things or objects that respond better to us. But really, those changes are major.
And we'll discuss the future of communication with Vice President of Design at Nokia, Marco Artisari.
We're going to see layers into everyday life of more devices and products that are dedicated, they're smaller, closer to the skin on us, in us, with us, that will do one or two things really well, and these will have mechanical interfaces.
We'll also be joined by Design Miami founder Ambra Meda. We'll hear about the Italian obsession with quality from Luca Liberali, and we'll find out how British designer Sam Hecht mastered the art of creating the perfect stool too. That's all to come over the next hour here on Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald. The 52nd annual Salone del Mobile Furniture Fair in Milan got off to a rather dreary start. It was cold and wet. Milan's many marbled halls and streets were lethally slippy. Talk of slashed rent prices and empty exhibition spaces did little to quell the sluggish moods on the city streets. But tucked away in the Museum of Science and Technology, we set up our mobile recording studio and got to work. The museum is one of Milan's nuggets of gold. Surrounded by ships, planes, submarines and trains, it tells the story of Italy's industrial prowess. Where better then than to host three live shows during the Salone? We kicked things off on Monday, day one, with founder of Danish design agency OEO, Thomas Licker. Licker, together with his business partner Anne-Marie Boyman, was exhibiting his latest project at Salone called Japan Handmade. It's an umbrella brand, sponsored by the Japanese government, that seeks to promote traditional Japanese handcraft, a way of publicising the more vital craft traditions outside the borders of the country. He sat down with me on day one to tell me more.
In short, the idea behind Japan Handmade is, well, of course, to support craftsmanship from Kyoto, but also to do it in a different way. As from my editorial background from over the many years back from another magazine, I've also been coming to fairs for many years, and I think this is my 15th Salone. But also seen a lot of promotions from Japanese government initiatives supporting craftsmanship, but also realizing how often they are only popping up one time and not coming back the next, which is a pity. So somehow,
this is the Japanese exhibitors that you see sort of once, but they never come back for the second.
Yeah, and I don't know the reason. Maybe it wasn't as big success, so there was no support to continue. Or, well, I don't know the reasons, but what the idea behind Japan Handmade was to make a difference for craftsmanship, and also, and doing so, it would have to be also from a business point of view. So for us, it was very important not only to just show craftsmanship in the more traditional, conservative way, but really to show the new movement and energy from Kyoto, and in that sense also build a sustainable business platform on a global market.
So it's about resuscitating these very old traditional crafts that are all over Japan, but maybe a higher concentration in Kyoto than most places, and give it a sort of more 21st century business approach and sort of branding that might appeal to people outside just regional Japan.
Yeah, that is the idea. And that is also why we call it Japan Handmade and not Kyoto Handmade.
Mm.
Of course, now it is the region of Kyoto. We're working with 6 craftsmen. We started out as 5, and that was called the Kyoto 5. So I had to come up with a new name, and it became Kyoto 6, looking to the Antwerp 6.
Oh, I can see what you did there.
Yeah. So, but maybe next time it's going to be 7, 10, we don't know.
When it gets to the Kyoto 26, it won't be quite so catchy.
Then we know it's been a good business.
But exactly. And so you have actually the 6 Kyoto craftsmen here with you at most. You're showing downstairs.
Yeah.
I mean, what do they make of this?
Well, we have a textile company, Hoso, where we have Masataka-san, who is the 12th generation of Hoso, and a part of the new young driven generation from craftsmen. We have Kaigado, which has 150 years of tea caddy makers. We have Asahiyaki, which is porcelain and ceramic, which is actually the oldest of the companies that were established in 1664. And Hoso also has a 400 years of history. So we're talking about companies that has such a long history and tradition, which is in itself is amazing. And very much what they built on from the craft perspective is still these traditional
expertise that's been passed down from hand to hand.
Yeah, and almost ritual way of making things.
Mm.
So to us also, when we helped the craftsmen build a more international platform and design, it's actually almost non-design because it was important that the design came natural and not forced, but really supporting the craft and more like guiding them. And in that sense, it becomes non-design. It feels like it's natural evolution of what they've been doing.
It's quite an extraordinary sort of symptom of the way the design industry has gone to have 6 Kyoto craftsmen under the same roof at Salone as the founder of Fab.com.
I think that's the beauty of design, actually. There's not really a right way to do it. I mean, there's multiple ways to do things, and I think both are important. Of course, technology is super important for how we evolve design today, but I think it's also, and especially to me, super important to nurture craftsmanship and, you know, really appreciate the beauty of things and also the time it takes. Otherwise, we'd just have an IKEA society, and I wouldn't be a part of that.
No, quite right. My final question to you quickly. I was lucky enough to come and visit you and Kyoto. Well, there were 5 at that stage in your home territory of Kyoto. I mean, do people still understand the products when they're not in that environment in the back streets of Kyoto? When you take the products and these craft stories and place them in Milan around the, you know, nucleus of the design industry, will people still understand it?
They do understand. And I think also we got amazing support, not only from, Monaco was the first to really tell the story, and that was an amazing start for us. Actually, Japan Handmade has become one of the most successful government-sponsored projects, and we have got amazing coverage from all over the world. People really tap into it. They understand. And I think what we have done, we have actually taken the local craftsmanship to a global context. And that was what was important for us, really to build on the local craft, but take it to a new market.
That was Thomas Licker, founder of Danish design agency OEO, telling me about Japan Handmade there. You're listening to a Salone del Mobile special edition of Section D. Lots more coming up, including robots, biscuits, and a bit of light opera too.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back. And for those just joining us, you're listening to a special Salone del Mobile-themed Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald, on Monocle 24. Our next guest is no stranger to design fairs. Ambra Meda, in fact, set up her very own one, Design Miami, in 2005. It caught and propelled the wave of design art into something of a phenomenon, and Meadow is credited with pulling design into a new realm, adding cachet, glamour, and even a dose of celebrity to the industry. Meadow left her post at Design Miami in 2010. She didn't take early retirement, though. No, she's been busier than ever, and she joined me on Monday's briefing to tell us exactly what she's been up to.
So we've been very busy in the last year and a half setting up what is going to be my new business, which is l'arcobaleno.com. It's a website that is presented as a magazine online, and there is e-commerce, so we'll be creating a lot of content, video, lots of stories about design and what's happening. And it's extremely curated. I'll be curating objects from all over the world, so anything from baskets from Botswana to houses by Prouvé. And the pieces will be for sale, and we launch in May.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I'm very excited.
Quite a lot of sleepless nights at the moment, I'm sure, getting that together.
I'm very underslept right now.
This whole sort of juxtaposition between online, which seems to have more of a presence, sort of digital companies, versus this complete return to craft, which all seems to be happening together in the same spaces, even during this Salone. Is it a geographical division, do you think, that in America, where obviously tech seems to rule, versus Europe, slightly more old-fashioned, maybe a little bit stuck in ruts, some would say, where we are still talking and obsessed with people making things with their hands and selling in a traditional way?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, technology is today's craft. And so in a way, it's really just supporting what is happening both in digital and human terms. Definitely, America is so much more online oriented. I think people are just so much more used to shopping online. I mean, I even do my grocery shopping online, which is something that I never thought I would do. And people are just more, you know, they're online all day. Mm. I've been in Europe pretty much since January, and I have to say, just talking about the new business, speaking to people in Europe, they do seem to have not a resistance, but they just don't have it. It's not quite under their belt yet.
Yeah, there's reservations and a sort of apprehension.
Absolutely. But it's quite clearly the future, and I think it's already happening. It's not like this is the next thing, it's already here.
I mean, quite a lot of the debate that we have at Monocle surrounds the fact that when people sort of move into a virtual or digital world, that some of the sort of charm is lost between human interaction. I mean, service primarily is sort of killed if you're only ever really buying things with a click of a mouse. Is that an old-fashioned argument, do you think? Or is it something that we
need to be careful
not to kill?
Yeah, I mean, I think it will be an old-fashioned argument quite soon. But I think, you know, face-to-face is unbeatable. That's, you know, there's no question about it. And, you know, we're faced with the challenge of how to present furniture and how to bring it to life digitally, because these pieces are so extraordinary and you can really only appreciate them if you're in person with them.
So how will you go about doing that? Will you still take things to fairs so that people can see?
Or certainly we'll do events that translate what we're doing online. So it could be curated shows, it could be parties, it could be installations, different partnerships with different companies and craftsmen will probably manifest. But, you know, the challenge to present things online is certainly how to humanize things that are, you know, if you're presenting something that's made by people, how do you show it online and make it feel alive?
And presumably that's where the sort of magazine element of the site comes in, so that you have a platform to be able to tell the stories as well.
Absolutely. And you know, there's a lot of, you know, the big quest with the magazine is to be able to cover also things and people and bring objects that are, you know, maybe in remote places. And you can really only do that online and give a sort of a platform for, let's say, you know, people working in Botswana or Poland. Yeah, it's exciting. I mean, it's pretty much the center of everything. I mean, it's a big opportunity for everyone.
And you'll be based in New York?
New York and Berlin.
And Berlin.
Yeah.
Interesting. Why is Berlin the sort of...
It's the tech hub.
Really?
Yeah.
More so than Amsterdam, which is...
Most definitely.
You're listening to a special edition of Section D, stuffed with highlights of our coverage from the 52nd Salone del Mobile Furniture Fair in Milan. Luca Liberali, together with Maurizio Navone, founded Restart Milano just 3 years ago, with a collection of stunning products, not just made in Italy, but made in the very many workshops in and around Milan. These workshops are at the heart of Italy's design prowess. They were where modern Italian design was founded. And it's the same story, as with so much of the world of design, that the workshops and skilled workers are on the demise. Liberali curated an exhibition for Salone called Ossezione Italiana. It was a celebration of Italian design, which put the raw skill and production process of Italy's small producers firmly in the spotlight. He joined me on the briefing on day one of the Salone to tell me more.
What we wanted to do this year is to go a bit further. Made in Italy is something that has become a brand. Nobody really knows maybe what it means today or whether, you know, it makes any difference today. So we try to understand or to think about what makes a difference, or what has made a difference. And we found a number of different stories which are founded on what we, you know, at the end of the day called an obsession for detail, for quality, for, you know, getting, you know, pushing it further and further to get to perfection. And the interesting story, you know, the interesting angle about this story is that, I mean, these things, they don't happen because people want to make something which is very nice and so can be considered luxury and so can be sold at a high price. Mm-hmm. What we found is that some people do this way because this is the only thing they would like to do it. I mean, they wouldn't do it any different.
Do it out of being slaves to the quality and the detail rather than right. Thinking they can command a huge amount of money for it.
That's right. I mean, this is simply the way they are.
Yeah.
And so we collected, you know, 9 different stories, very diverse. Some of them have a commercial angle. Some of them are big companies. Some of them are individuals and don't have any commercial sense or commercial idea about what they're doing. So we arrange from Riva, the motorboat manufacturer, mm-hmm. to wonderful old ladies from Sicily who make the most amazing embroideries.
Lovely. So all across Italy, you collected these stories, yeah. These 9 stories. There's an intriguing building made of biscuits. What's that about?
Yeah. You know, when you talk about Italian obsession, you can't help talking about food.
Of course.
So there are a couple of food examples. One of them are these wafers called babbi. You should come and taste them. I mean, there's not much I can do. There's no much I can do to really to describe you the what they really are. So we discovered that the module, I mean, the basic dimension, the proportion of the babbi wafers were exactly the ones used by Miss Van der Rohe in the Barcelona pavilion. So if you want to come, you will see also a Miss Van der Rohe, you know, pavilion made out of wafers. So
amazing.
If you promise not to chew it, you can come and see it.
Luca, obviously there is a serious message at the heart of the exhibition that is about more than just celebrating Italian obsession.
Yeah.
This sad demise of people outsourcing for skills for cost reasons.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you want to get serious, you know, for 30 seconds, I think that in a number of ways, Italy has is getting itself into the kind of the losing side, you know? And I think that as Italians, we should think about what we are and try to define ourselves for what we are. And we don't need to, I mean, of course, you know, we have to be respectful. We have to listen to everybody, but we don't need to be told by everyone else who we are. And I think that there are so many ways that Italy has expressed itself in a wonderful, qualitative, beautiful manner, and we wanted to celebrate that. And of course, this is only a small sample. I mean, this is not what Italy is. This is a very small sample of what Italy is, and that can be, you know, with more time and more space, and, you know, and we would have, you know, thousands or hundreds of stories to tell.
Well, that's the thing, because I mean, traveling around Italy, I was on a road trip of northeast Italy just a few weeks ago. These stories are everywhere still, and yet from outside of Italy, all the stories that we read about Italy are understandably also focusing on political mess, the sort of economic downturn, which just seems to get worse. It's refreshing sometimes actually to try and forget about that and say, hang on, look, in this workshop there is somebody who makes a boat that is as delicate as a violin.
Exactly. And I mean, if you want to understand a little bit what we are, I think you have to turn, you know, the front page, maybe the first few pages, and get into something deeper. Go deeper and try and find something which is really, really what it should be.
That was Luca Liberale, founder of Restart Milano there at the Museum of Science and Technology. Still to come in part two of Section D, we'll find out about a Finnish 5-point plan to having the perfect day, and why drinks might soon be served by robots too. But first, we're talking Swiss consumer electronics. Amidst the bold and bombastic design on show during Salone, the quieter, cleverer little improvements to our daily lives can sometimes get lost. How could something like a slimline adapter compete with a cast of 15 new sofas? Swiss firm Punkt was founded in 2010 as the world tumbled into recession. Punkt makes consumer electronics, slowly, beautifully, precisely, and are soundproof that you don't have to stage an all-singing, dancing intervention to get noticed at Salone. Petter Nebby, Punkt's founder, joined us in the cafe of the Museum of Science and Technology on day two of the fair to tell us how.
Well, first of all, I think it's important to underline that in this industry, we call it this consumer electronics, not appliances.
Consumer electronics.
Because that would be sort of kitchen kind of thing.
Okay, yes.
Just to underline that, actually, it's interesting because for me, it's actually a fine line, which I think that some producers earlier actually overstepped. So I don't think it's nice to listen to a radio made of the same guy who actually made your shaver.
I quite agree. I mean, this is also the way that the design industry has gone over the last decade, where you can quite easily have your house built by the same person who has designed all the furniture and the electronics and everything in it as well, and naming no names at all, because these people obviously work very hard and are very talented.
Sure.
You could quite easily go around Milan at the Salone and only look at things designed by the same 10 people. You got Jasper Morrison, who is obviously one of the foremost designers in the world, on board to sort of creative direct the brand, I think.
He's an art director.
He's an art director.
Yes.
And he, although he is prolific, has a very different approach to some of the more celebrity designers that we bemoan sometimes. He stays out of the limelight and really puts the product first, doesn't he? And I mean, was that a conscious decision that he was somebody in the way that he worked that you wanted to get on board because he had the identity that you wanted for the brand?
Well, of course, absolutely. You know, I think I've been thinking of Punkt for at least 10 years before I started Punkt, and I never thought of anyone who could sort of realize my ideas than Jasper. So I've always been asked, you know, why did you choose Jasper? Well, I couldn't choose anyone else. And that's why we work together, and that's, I think, why we also obviously work very well together as well.
Now, you launched in 2010 at a time when most people would have been running away, terrified at the idea of launching a business. How did you manage to negotiate the whole economic environment and downturn with setting up a brand in the first place?
Well, it was harsh, you know, and however, if you mean something seriously, I think rain or shine doesn't really matter. You just go for it. And when you do, you know, entrepreneurship is a little bit like closing your eyes and just don't look too far ahead. Don't look too much sideways all of the time, because you can analyze it to death and you won't get on with it. So that's a little bit what we did. You know, I had the possibility, because of my expertise and knowledge about how distribution works. I knew distribution, and I just said, you know, I really think that what Punkt is about has a lot to give, and that's why I think also there will be a resonance, whether it will be crisis or not.
You said a little earlier that you had had the idea for Punkt for a long time. Why did you feel that the world needed another consumer electronics brand?
Well, because Punkt is about monofunctional products, and I think the more the smartphones have overtaken the central piece of our, you know, everyday life, it's more and more obvious to me, has been for a while, that it actually is a compromised thing, not that it's focusing on, you can't get everything into one small piece, even however beautiful it is designed. It actually has to compromise certain things. And on top of that, of course, I think it's also an answer to this use and throw kind of culture, which we all, even, Asia, Western Europe, we all are more and more conscious about. It's not so good. So changing your smartphone because there's something better in the next 18 months is not such a great idea. And so buying something that actually lasts and should last for 10 years at least is a good answer to that.
Definitely. And we all talk about the convenience of the smartphone and the fact that electronics in so many ways are getting smaller and soaking up so much more of our lives. Punk is sort of stripping it out, really, and taking things back. You talk about monofunctional as being so really the key word there. Is this just for a niche elite who feels similar to you, or do you think that actually you're ahead of the game in this time? In maybe 10, 15 years, everybody will be a bit sick of having something even smaller in their pockets that takes over most of their lives, and they'll crave actually more things that are monofunctional?
I'm convinced that that will happen. We are sort of children in candy store at the moment, and we jump on everything new and exciting. Right, in a way, rightly so as well. I must say, I've been doing software companies for almost 20 years, and I know a lot about technologies and excitement around gadgets, etc. However, once you grow more conscious about the real qualities that these gadgets actually do give or do not support, apart from what that great word convenience is about, I think you have a conscious selection possibility there, then you will understand that. So it's a little bit, for me, being here, for instance, to talk about, for me, it's a gospeling the qualities of monofunctionality,
Finally, Petter, I want to ask if is it something that you notice with your distribution and where Punkt products are most successful, that some cultures are a little bit ahead than others in terms of wanting to return to that simplicity?
Well, I must say I have been very surprised how relatively successful we have been in the United States. When we started Punkt, I was only looking eastwards. I didn't even consider going with a telephone. I didn't actually do an American version in the first go. I was going eastwards towards Japan and, slowly thinking Southeast Asia as well. So there, in certain parts there, it has been an enormous feedback from, it's not that we have sold like millions of products. It's just that there's a lot of talk, a lot of contacts from there, a lot of appreciation about what we're doing, and that was very, very interesting.
You're listening to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald, on Monocle 24. After this short break, we'll be hearing about the future of manufacturing from MIT Professor Carlo Ratti.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Ever thought of shaking off those golden handcuffs? Or had a daydream about going solo, striking out, far from the gentle plod of your day job? Then it's time you tuned in to The Entrepreneurs. Every week, we meet the brave, intrepid, sometimes audacious businessmen and women who have done just that.
What we're trying to do is not create a fragrance, but rather evoke something through scents.
It's a show that allows you to learn business nouse by example. So, if you want to learn how to open a thriving organic bakery, patent a savvy invention, set up an artisanal microbrewery, or export a finely crafted product to the world, The Entrepreneurs, the living, working audio Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
This is Section D on Monocle 24. Welcome back. We're bringing you highlights from the 52nd Salone del Mobile in Milan. And as well as the wealth of furniture and homeware on show, Salone is also the forum for discussion and investigation into the future of the design industry too. When it comes to manufacturing, this future appears to be digital. Robots are taking over. But does this mean good old-fashioned hands and human skills are in jeopardy? Carlo Ratti is professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, otherwise known as MIT, and he hosted two shows during the Salone that introduced us to some of the more cutting-edge frontiers of manufacturing and technology.
We got two shows. One show is with Cassina, the furniture producer, and actually gave us a brief around a year ago. And that's, you know, how is technology changing our furniture? And then we started exploring different dimensions. You know, there's a way that technology is changing manufacturing. And then there's a way that actually technology is changing the interaction with furniture itself. And there's also a way that technology is changing us. And then we need new types of furniture around ourselves. And so that resulted in a show that we have at the Cassina showroom. It's in Via Durini here in Milan. Where actually we got a number of prototypes. There are still prototypes, but you know, you can play with it. You know, you can use them and so on, and you know, try to explore all these different three dimensions.
And when you talk about technology and how they can shape furniture production, what does that mean exactly? Are we talking robots making furniture, or instead of a man with a lathe and a saw? Because I mean, it's interesting to hook up with Cassina, which is one of the more heritage made in Italy furniture brands. Where really, I was actually in their R&D facility a couple of weeks ago. Everything is still made by hand, largely. Sort of technology are we talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. And you certainly want that quality, because that quality is the Cassina quality. That quality is really what you want to have in the objects. But at the same time, you can do things you couldn't do before. So like, let me give you a quick example. So one of the tables you can see there is actually something that's, that people say, you know, it looks a bit magic, because it's like a coffee table that you can open and takes many shapes. Now, the only way you could do that is by having all these different hinges. Every hinge is different from the other one, and they are, you know, customize everyone different from the other, so they create almost like an implicit programming into the system that allows you to take many configurations. Now, that type of thing you couldn't do before.
It's a bit like a Rubik's Cube in my head.
You should see. No, it's not like that. It's actually much more sensual. It's curved, and, you know, it opens up and it touches you and so on. So it has that tactile quality. But at the same time, it opens up and allows you to do things that you couldn't do before. And that's one example. But if you think about production, you know, there's many things. And we believe, you know, in the end, all of this is not about technology, it's about humans. It's about, you know, how we can do things or objects that respond better to us. But really, those changes are major. And that's actually the subject of the other installation we have. It's in the Galleria del Corso. It's just behind the Duomo, the main piazza in Milan. And there, you know, that actually started with an invitation by Google. And they asked us a few months ago, you know, what could we do together in order to show the third industrial revolution? And the third industrial revolution is this paradigm that people can be more creative, and then machines will build things, and then we enjoy then the result of that production together. And if you want, it's like this, the old situationist utopia, the one from Constantine in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you know, about, you know, man liberated from labor, and, you know, everybody can kind of become an artist in their daily life. And so we're thinking about how can we show this, how can we, you know, do a project that will show this. And then we say, well, you know, people come to Salon and people go to Google I.O. in California in the end to have a drink and be together. So what about doing just this thing, which will be for the first time you'll be able to make your drink on your phone, you mix the ingredients, you become the bartender and you do all the things you want. And then you send it and you got this robot just producing anything you want. So mixing the ingredients, mixing the alcohol, and then slicing the lemon, adding the mint, doing a mojito, whatever you want, any cocktail. And then, you know, you drink it, and at the same time you see, you know, you follow other people who've done other drinks, you invent new drinks, you have this social component, you see the group of people drinking rum, or people drinking cachaça, or the crazy ones mixing, I don't know, cachaça and Armagnac. So, you know, it becomes like, you know, this thing where actually the social experience take over, because again, you know, this is not about machine, it's about humans, it's about people, it's about us.
And everyone loves a drink. But Carlo, so this is a robot then that I understand you can program from your phone the contents that you want in your drink and how it's made and what happens to it, and then the robot miraculously produces the drink for you.
Yeah, it's actually three robots, and, you know, they pass each other the glasses. They do exactly what a bartender could do, very, very fast, and actually more things. And then you're the one who's in charge of things. Mm. So you mix ingredients on your phone, you see how much cachaça or rum or whatever you want to add. This is a project we've been doing with a partnership of Coca-Cola and Bacardi. So really, it has actually made a calculation. We got almost to one goggle of combinations that you can do. It's a 10 power 100 of different drinks you can do. You know, the people can experiment and share. It's a kind of an experiment in, I would say, in social production and consumption, and how interfaces are changing with our machines.
That was Carlo Ratti, MIT professor there, talking to us on The Briefing on Tuesday last week. You're listening to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald, on Monocle 24. As well as the slew of exhibitions and product launches on show throughout the week of Salone del Mobile, there's a rapidly growing number of talks, conferences and debates taking place too. A new addition to the landscape this year was the Lexus Design Awards. The Japanese car company cut the ribbon on their inaugural awards on Tuesday at the Museo della Permanente. Following a call for entries in October, to which they received 1,243 submissions, 10 winners were chosen by a judging panel, and two of those 10 were chosen to develop their products into prototypes. The chosen design teams were assigned a mentor each to develop their idea into the prototype, and I sat down with one of the mentors, British designer Sam Hecht of Industrial Facility, to hear a little more.
Well, Lexus decided to introduce a new concept to design competition, and I'm not really particularly attracted to design competitions and judging and those sorts of things, just because they tend to be judging the two dimensions of a project. But with Lexus, it was slightly different enough to be quite intriguing, in that I was able to select a winner and then essentially mentor them, so meet with them on a regular basis and enter into a dialogue with the young designer, with the premise that it would lead to something produced, and then Lexus would provide a platform for them to show their work. So in some ways, it was very much teaching and guiding the entrant.
Rather than just celebrating a product in isolation of anything, which most design awards tend to be. Tell me a little bit about the person that you selected and what their work involves.
Well, that's you mentioned it quite right. I mean, generally, lots of competitions are kind of in a vacuum. But obviously, with this one being something where I felt it needed to be produced, it meant that what I was actually looking for was some evidence of the criteria of the competition, but more importantly, some evidence that they'd started on the journey of making it, which these two Japanese designers had done. And what intrigued me was that they were producing a piece of design which was completely and utterly ephemeral. It didn't really have any function to it. It was essentially light and motion, and the idea that as you walk past it, it brought the light to you, but it wasn't lighting you up, it was almost dancing in front of you. And it intrigued me because it's not normally something that I would be attracted to, but they had actually already entered into the process of prototyping and those sorts of things.
And so the culmination of the Lexus Design Awards means that at the end of it, you will have accompanied these designers on the end of, or to a journey, and then they have a product that will go into production. Is that the idea of the whole thing?
I think production is probably too grand a word. It's very experimental, very conceptual, but it's something that people can come and experience. You know, it's a real thing. But I think that, you know, what Lexus have done is they've, just like other car companies, they're occupying a space where they are providing a platform and money for very young designers to be able to try something out. And I think previously that was done by, you know, the great design factories, but they've kind of slightly removed themselves from that kind of commissioning and benefactor role. And so I think it's full kudos to Lexus for now occupying that space.
Absolutely. It's a 21st century mode of patronage in one way, isn't it?
Yeah, very much.
Well, Sam, you have another hat on at Salone as well, not just design judge, but designer, of course, yourself. And you are launching the second product for one of my favourite producers turned manufacturers, Mattiazzi. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, we're very excited about it. It's our first project with Mattiazzi was about 2 years ago, which was a culmination of a chair made by robots called Brunker, completely entirely out of wood. and that is Mattiazzi's speciality. And this year we looked at the world of stools and really pushed them more into that concept of this combination of robot and craftsmanship. And the stool is called Radice, and it comes in several different heights. And it's a very, very, very sculptural endeavor, probably the most, you could say, sculptural that I've entertained myself in. But it's beautiful, and it's just beautifully produced, and it's affordable, and it's a delight to use.
I remember 2 years ago when Branko was launched, talking to you and you explaining about this extraordinary communion of handmade, age-old skill mixed with incredibly high-tech manufacturing process with CNC milling. I think it had seven arms or something, the robot or something. This is an extension of that even further into the combination, or are we still giving everything over to the robots now?
No, it's still very much a combination. I mean, I think that I would never let that go, and I don't think they would either. So it does have a combination of different processes, because the one thing that still is a premise to their production, and in fact production in general, is that the time for a robot is actually quite expensive, believe it or not. And so you have to kind of contemplate that if you want to make a chair as beautiful as Radice that is still accessible for people to consume and to use. And I think that the result, I mean, for me, it's a very, very unusual stool visually. It looks as though it won't necessarily perform as a stool, and I think that's the beauty of it. It's a very unusual piece.
I'm interested, you mentioned a little bit earlier that it's actually affordable as well, which flies in the face of most things that are using very high-tech methods of production. How have you managed to do that?
I think it's a combination of understanding the equation between man-made and robotically made, but also the equation of material and how much you're using and those sorts of things. And you, at the end of that equation, as long as you involve that in the process, you can kind of make decisions and move into a space that is not overtly expensive, that would render the project completely ridiculous anyway. So I think it's really, for me, another level of maturity that a designer needs to involve to production.
Sam Hecht of Industrial Facility there at the inaugural Lexus Design Awards during Salone del Mobile. Bringing people together from different sectors of the industry and different parts of the globe is without a doubt Salone's greatest trump card. Talked to many visitors this year and they said they'd taken a different approach to doing the Salone though. Instead of ticking off the major brands and zooming round the fair, clocking up sofa trends and late-breaking table shapes, they attended panel talks, discussions and debates and used the time in between to set up meetings. Salone is not just about furniture. It's a good litmus test for the future of the way we might live, too. Over a breakfast of Carnel Buller on Wednesday morning, a select gathering got down to discussing the future of communication in everyday life, hosted by Finnish brands Nokia and Ittila. No easy task, you might think. Well, we were joined soon after by one of the hosts, Marco Attisari, Nokia's Vice President of Design, to tell us more.
We got together, Harri Koskinen, who's a close friend, creative director at Ittala, and I, what we did was, first of all, we were showcasing our latest Nokia Lumia products alongside beautiful Ittala, kind of in swaths of color. But one thing we did was we showed a prototype. One thing Alvar Aalto said is never forget to play. So we played a little bit at the workshop in Helsinki, and what Harri and Ittala did is they took the Sarjaton tray and we embedded wireless charging in it. One of the things I think everybody that you've seen here is struggling with is how to keep your smartphones charged at Salone.
Tell me about it.
And what we've done is we've led the way with wireless charging, essentially something we do every day, a repeated pattern. You just lay the phone on a charging pad, and now by embedding it even in other everyday objects, charging becomes part of the environment. So we take interactions that normally would require much more effort and attention, cables, planning, now becomes something very just serendipitous. You lay it down and charge it. And I think this is one trend is that these things that you do every day will just become embedded into the environment. They'll be more glanceable in terms of the user interfaces, not requiring so much effort and attention. And it was well received.
I'm sure it was. It sounds very practical and very Finnish as well, and that's a seamless embedding design into life, which was, of course, the major push behind Helsinki World Design Capital last year as well. And I know you were very much involved in that, as was everybody, impressively, not just in Helsinki, but so many Finns. Has it been a success? It's interesting to have you here now to be able to say, you know, 1 year after Helsinki was the World Design Capital, was there benefits to it that will live longer than that year?
It's interesting you raise it in this context, because there were quite a few applications of design thinking beyond the design area. And I think that's where you'll see the longer term effects. I don't see it so much in the areas of traditional design or communication or awareness of design. One of the projects I liked the most was actually called Redesigning 925. I don't know if you heard about it. We weren't involved in it particularly, but they worked with 10 companies, a small studio. Essentially, they gave themselves the brief, how do you redesign knowledge work and office work? So what would be a better work week? And one of the things they come up with, which I really like, is 4-3-2-1. So every day, and this is Hugo for you, every day, do 4 hours of good work. Good work is meaningful work on those things that are most important to you. That doesn't mean you only work 4 hours, but 4 hours of good work. Three goals a week. Two can be professional, one personal, if you make that distinction. And you use that as a filter for the 4 hours. Two steps to clear your mind. As that incoming stuff comes in, get it out of your short-term memory and cognition. Put it on a list or in your phone, wherever, and then have pauses and spaces during the day where you go through those lists. So get your mind clear so you can think creatively. And one, every day, give yourself license to think about one big creative question that you need to solve. And therefore, when you have any break, you're grabbing a coffee or walking to your next meeting, you allow yourselves to think about it. So 4-3-2-1. So that was one enduring legacy.
You make it sound so easy, Marco. Are you abiding by the 4-3-2-1 program yourself?
I think everyone that deals with intense knowledge work and competitive, you have some systems like that. I just like the way they summarized it. 4-3-2, I've been doing most of my life in some form. One I find interesting because it allows you to focus and give yourself license to think creatively about one thing. That usually gets your subconscious going. So I notice, having applied that, you're swimming in the morning, which I do a kilometer every day, and suddenly you just notice that, that's what might be a path forward. So,
well done you. I'm going to try and master that myself. It's interesting though, because many of the points that you've just brought up there are things that I've been hearing and seeing from many of the guests that we've had on the radio while we've been here at Milan. And this whole seems to be a very clear divide between either incorporating technology into your way of life in a way that actually declutters it somehow, or returning to something that is very craft-based and tactile and so in many ways completely eschewing technology and mastering skills that connect people to nature all over again. I mean, these two tenets are really at the heart of Finnish design as well, and something that you yourself have really tried to incorporate into Nokia. How's that going?
If we look at the identity of our new Nokia Lumia product, so there's a certain purity there, taking away everything unnecessary, but you're still left with something that has warmth to it, that has a humanness. And in the studio, we actually talk about very seriously and that technology should make us more human. And if you really take that seriously, that's a very tall order. So we were talking a little bit earlier about glanceable user interfaces or interfaces that don't require more attention. You walk even here in, let's say, this wonderful tea room here, you'll see couples pinching and zooming with their heads down. We have the goal to design for people to have their head up again. What does that mean? It means better glanceable user interfaces, more mechanical user interfaces to the digital. So I think the interesting thing about the technology industry, it has huge waves. And these waves are typically, there are a few companies controlling a certain way. But we're going to see layers into everyday life of more devices and products that are dedicated. They're smaller, closer to the skin on us, in us, with us. That'll do one or two things really well, and these will have mechanical interfaces. So I think that trend is important. The other one is personalization. You said it, how does it go into structure? With my Nokia Lumia, if you even take a look at the screen here, it's all full of people. And these are the people I communicate with most. And it's all centered around the people, places, and actions I do every day, not apps. So it's not screens of apps where you have to, which one was that one I needed to check, but rather it disintegrates into the actions that you want to do and personalizing that.
That was Marco Artisari extolling the virtues of communication there. And that brings us to the end of this week's Salone del Mobile special of Section D. But fear not, we'll be doing a part two next week too, bringing you news from Hermes, Japanese dog accessories, Bang & Olufsen speakers, John Paulson, and many, many more delights too. So be sure to tune in then. Today's show was produced by Alid John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact Alid at awj@monocle.com if you want to feature on Section D, or perhaps just bend his ear about an idea you've had. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and playing you out, here's something of an Italian classic, which Marco Artisari belted a bit out to warm up his vocals. This is Nessun Dorma from Puccini's opera Turandot. Thank you for listening.